most interesting, because their jobs quite likely involve significant physical labor. 1964 through 1965, Johannesburg, South Africa. Researchers from the South African Institute for Medical Research study urban Bantu pensioners older than 60. The most indigent of elderly Bantu, which means the poorest members of an exceedingly poor population. The women in this population average 165 pounds. 30% of them are severely overweight. The average weight of poor white women is also reported to be 165 pounds. 1965, North Carolina. 29% of adult Cherokee on the Quala Reservation are obese. 1969, Ghana. 25% of the women and 7% of the men attending medical outpatient clinics in Accra are obese, including half of all women in their 40s. It may be reasonably concluded that severe obesity is common in women aged 30 to 60, writes an associate professor at the University of Ghana Medical School. And it is fairly common knowledge that many market women in the coastal towns of West Africa are fat. 1970, Lagos, Nigeria. 5% of the men are obese, as are nearly 30% of the women. Of women between 55 and 65, 40% are very obese. 1971, Rarotonga, the South Pacific. 40% of the adult women are obese. 25% are grossly obese. 1974, Kingston, Jamaica. Rolf Richards, a British-trained physician running a diabetes clinic at the University of the West Indies, reports that 10% of the adult men in Kingston and 2/3 of the women are obese. 1974, Chile, again. A nutritionist from the Catholic University in Santiago reports on a study of 3,300 factory workers, most engaged in heavy labor. Only 11% of the men and 9% of the women are severely undernourished. Only 14% of the men and 15% of the women are severely overweight. Of those 45 and older, nearly 40% of the men and 50% of the women are obese. He also reports on studies in Chile from the 1960s, noting that the lowest incidence of obesity exists among farm workers. Office workers show the most obesity, but it is also common among slum dwellers. 1978, Oklahoma. Kelly West, the leading diabetes epidemiologist of the era, reports of the local Native American tribes that men are very fat, women are even fatter. 1981 through 1983, Starr County, Texas. On the Mexican border, 200 miles south of San Antonio, William Mueller and colleagues from the University of Texas weigh and measure more than 1,100 local Mexican-American residents. 40% of the men in their 30s are obese, although most of them are employed in agricultural labor and/or work in the oil fields in the country. More than half the women in their 50s are obese. As for the living conditions, Mueller later describes them as very simple. There was one restaurant in all of Starr County, a Mexican restaurant, and there was nothing else. So why were they fat? What makes the overeating, calories in, calories out argument so convenient, suspiciously so, is that it always provides an answer to this question. If the population was so poor and malnourished that even the most stalwart believer in immoderate eating as the cause of obesity will have trouble imagining that they had too much food available. The Pima, for instance, during the 1900s or 1950s, the Sioux in the 1920s, the Trinidadians or the slum dwellers of Chile in the 1960s and 1970s, then it can always be claimed that they must have been sedentary, or at least too sedentary. If they were obviously physically active, the Pima women, the the Chilean factory workers or the Mexican-American agricultural laborers and oil field workers, then it can be claimed that they ate too much. The same arguments can and will be made for individual cases as well. If we're fat and we can prove that we eat in moderation, we don't eat any more, say, than do our lean friends or siblings, the experts will confidently assume that we must be physically inactive. If we're carrying excess fat, but obviously get plenty of exercise, then the experts will assume with equal confidence that we eat too much. If we're not gluttons, then we must be guilty of sloth. If we're not slothful, then gluttony is our sin. These claims can be made, and often are, without knowing a single other pertinent fact about either the relevant populations or individuals. Indeed, they're often made with little desire or inclination to learn more. In the early 1970s, nutritionists and research-minded physicians would discuss the observations of high levels of obesity in these poor populations, and they would occasionally do so with an open mind as to the cause. They were curious, as we should be, and hesitant to insist they knew the answer, as we should be. This was a time when obesity was still considered a problem of malnutrition rather than overnutrition, as it is today. A 1971 survey in Czechoslovakia, for instance, revealed that nearly 10% of the men were obese and a third of the women. When these data were reported in conference proceedings a few years later, the researcher who did so began with this statement. Even a brief visit to Czechoslovakia would reveal that obesity is extremely common and that, as in other industrial countries, it is probably the most widespread form of malnutrition. Referring to obesity as a form of malnutrition comes with no moral judgments attached, no belief system, no veiled insinuations of gluttony and sloth. It merely says that something is wrong with the food supply, and it might behoove us to find out what. Here's Rolf Richards, the British-turned-Jamaican diabetes specialist, discussing the evidence and the quandary of obesity and poverty in 1974, and doing so without any preconceptions. It is difficult to explain the high frequency of obesity seen in a relatively impecunious, very poor society, such as exists in the West Indies, when compared to the standard of living enjoyed in the more developed countries. Malnutrition and subnutrition are common disorders in the first 2 years of life in these areas, and account for almost 25% of all admissions to pediatric wards in Jamaica. Subnutrition continues in early childhood to the early teens. Obesity begins to manifest itself in the female population from the 25th year of life and reaches enormous proportions from 30 onwards. When Richard says subnutrition, he means there wasn't enough food. From birth through the early teens, West Indian children were exceptionally thin, and their growth was stunted. They needed more food, not just more nutritious food. Then obesity manifested itself, particularly among women, and exploded in these individuals as they reached maturity. This is the combination we saw among the Sioux in 1928 and later in Chile. Malnutrition and/or undernutrition or subnutrition coexisting in the same population with obesity, often even in the same families. Here's that same observation discussed more recently, but now steeped in the paradigm that overeating is the cause of obesity. This is from a 2005 New England Journal of Medicine article, A Nutrition Paradox: Underweight and Obesity in Developing Countries, written by Benjamin Caballero, head of the Center for Human Nutrition at Johns Hopkins University. Caballero describes his visit to a clinic in the slums of São Paulo, Brazil. The waiting room, he writes, was full of mothers with thin, stunted young children, exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition. Their appearance, sadly, would surprise few who visit poor urban areas in the developing world. What might come as a surprise is that many of the mothers holding these undernourished infants were themselves overweight. Caballero then describes the difficulty that he believed this phenomenon presents. The coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to public health programs, since the aims of programs to reduce undernutrition are obviously in conflict with those for obesity prevention. Put simply, if we want to prevent obesity, we have to get people to eat less. But if we want to prevent undernutrition, we have to make more food available. What do we do? The coexistence of thin, stunted children, exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition, with mothers who are themselves overweight, doesn't pose a challenge to public health programs, as Caballero suggested. It poses a challenge to our beliefs, our paradigm. If we believe that these mothers were overweight because they ate too much, and we know the children are thin and stunted because they're not getting enough food, then we're assuming that the mothers were consuming superfluous calories that they could have given to their children to allow them to thrive. In other words, the mothers are willing to starve their children so that they themselves can overeat. This goes against everything we know about maternal behavior. So what's it going to be? Do we throw out everything we believe about maternal behavior so we can keep our beliefs about obesity and overeating intact? Or do we question our beliefs about the cause of obesity and let our beliefs about the sacrifices mothers will make for their children remain intact? Again, the coexistence of underweight and overweight in the same populations and even in the same families doesn't pose a challenge to public health programs. It poses a challenge to our beliefs about the cause of obesity and overweight. And it shouldn't be the only thing that does, as we'll see in the chapters that follow. Chapter 2. The Elusive Benefits of Undereating. In the early 1990s, the National Institutes of Health set out to investigate a few critical issues of women's health. The result was the Women's Health Initiative, WHI, a collection of studies that would cost in the neighborhood of $1 billion. Among the questions that the researchers hoped to answer was whether low-fat diets actually prevent heart disease or cancer, at least in women. So they enrolled nearly 50,000 women in a trial, chose 20,000 at random, and instructed them to eat a low-fat diet rich in fruits, vegetables, and fiber. These women were given regular counseling to motivate them to stay on the diet. One of the effects of this counseling, or maybe of the diet itself, is that the women also decided, consciously or unconsciously, to eat less. According to the WHI researchers, the women, on average, consumed 360 calories a day less on their diets than they did when they first agreed to participate. If we believe that obesity is caused by overeating, we might say that these women were undereating by 360 calories a day. They were eating almost 20% fewer calories than what public health agencies tell us such women should be eating. The result? After 8 years of such undereating, these women lost an average of 2 pounds each, and their average waist circumference, a measure of abdominal fat, increased. This suggests that whatever weight these women lost, if they did, was not fat, but lean tissue, muscle. This wasn't the only disappointing result in the study. The WHI investigators also reported that the low-fat diet failed to prevent heart disease, cancer, or anything else. How is such a thing possible? If our weight is really determined by the difference between the calories we consume and the calories we expend, these women should have slimmed down significantly. A pound of fat contains roughly 3,500 calories worth of energy. If these women were really undereating by 360 calories a day, They should have lost more than 2 pounds of fat, 7,000 calories worth, in the first 3 weeks, and more than 36 pounds in the first year. This calculation is oversimplified to make a point. If it is corrected for the observation that subjects who lose weight in diet studies expend less energy as they do it, then the amount of weight loss expected with this energy deficit should be less, approximately 1.6 pounds at 3 weeks and 22 pounds at 1 year. I owe this correction to Kevin Hall, a biophysicist at the NIH, who points out that the corrected numbers are still a far cry from the observed value. And these women had plenty of fat to lose. Almost half began the study obese. The great majority were at the very least overweight. One possibility, of course, is that the researchers failed miserably at assessing how much these women ate. Maybe the women deceived the investigators and themselves as well. Maybe they didn't undereat by 360 calories a day. We have no idea what these women were really eating because, like most people, when asked about their diet, they lied about it, as Michael Pollan suggested in the New York Times. Another possibility is that this reduction in calories, this multi-year exercise in undereating, just didn't do what it was expected to do. Of all the reasons to question the idea that overeating causes obesity, the most obvious has always been the fact that undereating doesn't cure it. Yes, it's true. If you are stranded on a desert island and starved for months on end, you will waste away, whether you're fat or thin to begin with. Even if you are just semi-starved, your fat will melt away, as will a good share of your muscle. Try the same prescription in the real world, though, and try to keep it up indefinitely. Try to maintain the weight loss, and it works very rarely indeed, if at all. This should come as no surprise. As I suggested earlier, with the assistance of Hilda Brooks' wisdom and experience, most of us who are fat spend much of our lives trying to eat less. If it doesn't work when the motivation is merely decades of the intense negative reinforcement that accompanies obesity, social ostracism, physical impairment, increased rate of disease, can we really expect it to work just because an authority figure in a white coat insists that we give it a try? The fat person who has never tried to undereat is a rare bird. If you're still fat, as Brooke noted, that's a good reason to assume that undereating failed to cure you of this particular affliction, even if it has some short-term success at treating the most conspicuous symptom, excess adiposity. The very first time anyone published a review of the efficacy of undereating as a treatment for obesity, the psychologist Albert Stunkard and his colleague Mavis McLaren-Hume in 1959, this was their conclusion. Nothing much has changed since. Stunkard said their study was motivated by what he called the paradox between his own failure to treat obese patients successfully at his New York hospital clinic by restricting how much they eat, and the widespread assumption that such treatment was easy and effective. Stunkard and McLaren-Hume combed the medical literature and managed to find 8 articles in which physicians reported on their success rates treating obese and overweight patients in their clinics. The results, said Stunkard, were remarkably similar and remarkably poor. Most of these clinics were prescribing diets that allowed only 800 or 1,000 calories a day, maybe half what the WHI women said they were eating. And still only 1 in 4 patients ever lost as much as 20 pounds. Only 1 in 20 patients managed to lose as much as 40 pounds. Stunkard also reported on his own experience prescribing balanced diets of 800 to 1,500 calories a day to 100 obese patients in his own clinic. Only 12 lost as much as 20 pounds, and only 1 lost 40 pounds. 2 years after the end of the treatment, Stunkard wrote, only 2 patients had maintained their weight loss. Although Stunkard's analysis has widely been perceived as a condemnation of all methods of dietary treatment of obesity, the studies he reviewed included only calorie-restricted diets. The more recent assessments benefit from the use of computers and elaborate statistical analyses. But the results, as Stunkard might say, are still remarkably similar and remarkably poor. Prescribing low-calorie diets for obese and overweight patients, according to a 2007 review from Tufts University, leads, at best, to modest weight losses that are transient, that is, temporary. Typically, 9 or 10 pounds are lost in the first 6 months. After a year, much of what was lost has been regained. The Tufts review was an analysis of all the relevant diet trials in the medical journals since 1980. The single largest such trial ever done yields the very same answer. I don't count the WHI low-fat diet trial, because that was aimed at preventing heart disease and cancer, not losing weight. The researchers were from Harvard and the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, which is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and is the most influential academic obesity research institute in the United States. Together, they enrolled more than 800 overweight and obese subjects and then randomly assigned them to eat one of four diets. These diets were marginally different in nutrition composition, proportions of protein, fat, and carbohydrates, but all were substantially the same in that the subjects were supposed to undereat by 750 calories a day, a significant amount. The subjects were also given intensive behavioral counseling to keep them on their diets, the kind of professional assistance that very few of us ever get when we try to lose weight. They were even given meal plans every 2 weeks to help them with the difficult chore of cooking tasty meals that were also sufficiently low in calories. The subjects began the study, on average, 50 pounds overweight. They lost, on average, only 9 pounds. And once again, just as the Tufts review would have predicted, most of the 9 pounds came off in the first 6 months, and most of the participants were gaining weight back after a year. No wonder obesity is so rarely cured. Eating less, that is, under-eating, simply doesn't work for more than a few months, if that. This reality, however, hasn't stopped the authorities from recommending the approach, which makes reading such recommendations an exercise in what psychologists call cognitive dissonance, the tension that results from trying to hold two incompatible beliefs simultaneously. Take, for instance, the Handbook of Obesity, a 1998 textbook edited by three of the most prominent authorities in the field, George Bray, Claude Bouchard, and W.P.T. James. Dietary therapy remains the cornerstone of treatment, and the reduction of energy intake continues to be the basis of successful weight reduction programs, the book says. But it then states, a few paragraphs later, that the results of such energy-reduced restricted diets are known to be poor and not long-lasting. So why is such an ineffective therapy the cornerstone of treatment? The Handbook of Obesity neglects to say. The latest edition, 2005, of Joslin's Diabetes Mellitus, a highly respected textbook for physicians and researchers, is a more recent example of this cognitive dissonance. The chapter on obesity was written by Jeffrey Flier, an obesity researcher who is now dean of Harvard Medical School, and his wife and research colleague, Terry Maritos Flier. The Flyers also describe reduction of caloric intake as the cornerstone of any therapy for obesity. But then they enumerate all the ways in which this cornerstone fails. After examining approaches from the most subtle reductions in calories, eating, say, 100 calories less each day, with the hope of losing a pound every 5 weeks, to low-calorie diets of 800 to 1,000 calories a day, to very low-calorie diets, 200 to 600 calories, and even total starvation, they conclude that none of these approaches has any proven merit. Alas. Until the 1970s, low-calorie diets were referred to in medical literature as semi-starvation diets. After all, what's expected on these diets is that we eat half or even less of what we'd typically prefer to eat. But we can't be expected to semi-starve ourselves for more than a few months, let alone indefinitely, which is what such diets implicitly require if we are to maintain whatever weight loss we may initially experience. Very low-calorie diets are known as fasts because they allow barely any food at all. Again, it's hard to imagine fasting for more than a few weeks, maybe a month or two at best, and certainly we cannot keep it up forever once our excess fat is lost. The two researchers who may have had the best track record in the world treating obesity in an academic setting were George Blackburn and Bruce Bistrian of Harvard Medical School. In the 1970s, they began treating obese patients with a 600-calorie-a-day diet of only lean meat, fish, and fowl. "They treated thousands of patients," said Bistrian. "Half of them lost more than 40 pounds. This is an extraordinarily effective and safe way to get large amounts of weight loss," Bistrian said. But then Bistrian and Blackburn gave up on the therapy because they didn't know what to tell their patients to do after the weight was lost. The patients couldn't be expected to live on 600 calories a day forever. And if they returned to eating normally, they'd gain the weight right back. "The only medically acceptable alternative," said Bistrian, "was to give the patients drugs to kill their appetites, and they weren't willing to do that." So even if you lose most of your excess fat on one of these diets, you're then stuck with the "what happens now" problem. If you lose weight eating only 600 calories a day, or even 1,200, should it come as a surprise that you get fat again when you return to eating 2,000 calories a day or more? This is why the experts say a diet has to be something we can follow for life, a lifestyle program. But how is it possible to semi-starve ourselves or fast for more than a short time? As Bistrian said when I interviewed him a few years ago, echoing Bruch half a century earlier, "Undereating isn't a treatment or cure for obesity. It's a way of temporarily reducing the most obvious symptom. And if undereating isn't a treatment or a cure, this certainly suggests that overeating is not a cause." Chapter 3. The Elusive Benefits of Exercise. Imagine you're invited to a celebratory dinner. The chef's talent is legendary, and the invitation says that this particular dinner is going to be a feast of monumental proportions. "Bring your appetite," you're told. "Come hungry." How would you do it? You might try to eat less over the course of the day, maybe even skip lunch or breakfast and lunch. You might go to the gym for a particularly vigorous workout, or go for a longer run or swim than usual to work up an appetite. You might even decide to walk to the dinner rather than drive for the same reason. Now let's think about this for a moment. The instructions that we're constantly being given to lose weight: eat less, decrease the calories we take in, and exercise more, increase the calories we expend, are the very same things we'll do if our purpose is to make ourselves hungry, to build up an appetite, to eat more. Now the existence of an obesity epidemic, coincident with half a century of advice to eat less and exercise more, begins to look less paradoxical. Chris Williams, who blogs under the name Asclepius, had this insight. "We've seen the problems with eating less to produce weight loss. Now let's examine the flip side of the calories in, calories out equation. What happens when we increase our energy expenditure by upping our level of physical activity? It's now commonly believed that sedentary behavior is as much a cause of our weight problems as how much we eat. And because the likelihood that we'll get heart disease, diabetes, and cancer increases the fatter we become, the supposedly sedentary nature of our lives is now considered a causal factor in these diseases as well. Regular exercise is now seen as an essential means of prevention for all the chronic ailments of our day, except, of course, those of joints and muscles that are caused by excessive exercise. Considering the ubiquity of the message, the hold it has on our lives, and the elegant simplicity of the notion, burn calories, lose weight, prevent disease, wouldn't it be nice if it were true? As a culture, we certainly believe it is. Faith in the health benefit of physical activity is now so deeply ingrained in our consciousness that it's often considered the one fact in the controversial science of health and lifestyle that must never be questioned. There are indeed excellent reasons to exercise regularly. We can increase our endurance and fitness by doing so. We may live longer, perhaps, as the experts suggest, by reducing our risk of heart disease or diabetes, although this has yet to be rigorously tested. We may simply feel better about ourselves, and it's quite clear that many of us who do exercise regularly, as I do, become exceedingly fond of the activity. But the question I want to explore here is not whether exercise is fun or good for us, whatever that ultimately means, or a necessary adjunct of a healthy lifestyle, as the authorities are constantly telling us, but whether it will help us maintain our weight if we're lean, or lose weight if we're not. The answer appears to be no. Let's look at the evidence. I want to begin with the observation I made in Chapter 1 that obesity associates with poverty. In the United States, Europe, and other developed nations, the poorer people are, the fatter they're likely to be. It's also true that the poorer we are, the more likely we are to work at physically demanding occupations, to earn our living with our bodies rather than our brains. It's the poor and disadvantaged who do the grunt work of developed nations, who sweat out a living not just figuratively but literally. They may not belong to health clubs or spend their leisure time, should they have any, training for their next marathon, but they're far more likely than those more affluent to work in the fields and in factories, as domestics and gardeners, in the mines and on construction sites. That the poorer we are, the fatter we're likely to be, is one very good reason to doubt the assertion that the amounts of energy we expend on a day-to-day basis has any relation to whether we get fat. If factory workers can be obese, as I discussed earlier, and oil field laborers, it's hard to imagine that the day-to-day expenditure of energy makes much of a difference. Another very good reason to doubt that assertion is, once again, the obesity epidemic itself. We've been getting steadily fatter for the past few decades, and this might suggest, as many authorities do, the World Health Organization among them, that we've been getting more sedentary. But the evidence suggests the opposite, certainly in the United States, where the obesity epidemic has coincided with what we might call an epidemic of leisure time physical activity, of health clubs and innovative means of expending energy, inline skating, mountain biking, step and elliptical machines, spinning and aerobics, Brazilian martial arts classes, the list goes on. Virtually all of which were either invented or radically redesigned since the obesity epidemic began. There are many ways to quantify this epidemic of physical activity. Health club industry revenues, for example, increased from an estimated $200 million in 1972 to $16 billion in 2005, a 17-fold increase when adjusted for inflation. The first year that the Boston Marathon had more than 300 entrants was 1964. In 2009, more than 26,000 men and women ran. The first New York City Marathon was in 1970, with 137 entrants. In 1980, there were 16,000 official runners, and in 2008, 39,000, although nearly 60,000 applied. According to the website marathonguide.com, nearly 400 marathons were scheduled in the United States in 2009, not to mention countless half marathons, more than 50 ultra marathons, 100 miles long, and 160 plus other ultras, up to 3,100 miles. Until the 1970s, Americans were not believers in the need to spend leisure hours sweating, not if they could avoid it. In the mid-1970s, as was pointed out by William Bennett and Joel Gurin in their 1982 book on obesity, The Dieter's Dilemma, it still seemed a little strange to see people go running down a city street in the colorful equivalent of underwear. But this is no longer the case. Indeed, the New York Times reported in 1977 that the United States was then in the midst of an exercise explosion, and this was only happening because the widespread belief of the 1960s that exercise was bad for you had been transformed into the new conventional wisdom that strenuous exercise is good for you. In 1980, the Washington Post reported that 100 million Americans had become active members of the new fitness revolution, and that many of these would have been derided as health nuts just a decade earlier. What we are seeing, the Post reported, is one of the late 20th century's major sociological events. But if sedentary behavior makes us fat, and physical activity prevents it, shouldn't the exercise explosion and the new fitness revolution have launched an epidemic of leanness rather than coinciding with an epidemic of obesity? As it turns out, very little evidence exists to support the belief that the number of calories we expend has any effect on how fat we are. In August 2007, the American Heart Association, AHA, and the American College of Sports Medicine, ACSM, addressed this evidence in a particularly damning manner when they published joint guidelines on physical activity and health. The 10 expert authors included many of the preeminent proponents of the essential role of exercise in a healthy lifestyle. Put simply, these were people who really want us to exercise and might be tempted to stack the evidence in favor of our doing so. 30 minutes of moderately vigorous physical activity, they said, 5 days a week, was necessary to maintain and promote health. But when it came to the question of how exercising affects our getting fat or staying lean, these experts could only say, it is reasonable to assume that persons with relatively high daily energy expenditures would be less likely to gain weight over time, compared with those who have low energy expenditures. So far, data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. The AHA-ACSM guidelines were a departure from the recent guidelines of other authoritative agencies, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, the International Association for the Study of Obesity, and the International Obesity Task Force, all of which recommended that we should exercise an hour a day. But the reason these other authorities advocate more exercise is not to help us lose fat, which they tacitly acknowledge cannot be done by exercising alone. Rather, it's to help us avoid getting fatter. The logic behind the one-hour recommendations is based precisely on the paucity of evidence to support the notion that exercising any less has had any effect. Since few studies exist to tell us what happens when people exercise for more than 60 minutes each day, these authorities can imagine that this much exercise might make a difference. The USDA guidelines have suggested that up to 90 minutes a day of moderately vigorous exercise, an hour and a half every day, may be necessary just to maintain weight loss. But they have not suggested that weight can be lost by exercising more than 90 minutes. The evidence leaves little room for argument. To call it not particularly compelling, as the American Heart Association and the American College of Sports Medicine did, is, well, a little unduly generous. A report that these expert guidelines often defer to as the basis for their assessments was published in 2000 by two Finnish exercise physiologists. These researchers looked at the results of the dozen best-constructed experimental trials that addressed weight maintenance. That is, successful dieters who were trying to keep off the pounds they had shed. They found that everyone in these studies regained weight. Depending on the type of trial, exercise would either decrease the rate of that gain, by 3.2 ounces per month or increase its rate by 1.8 ounces. As the Finns themselves concluded, with characteristic understatement, the relationship between exercise and weight is more complex than they might otherwise have imagined. One study that the Finns could not consider because it was published in 2006, 6 years later, is particularly revealing, both in what it concluded and how those conclusions were interpreted. The authors were Paul Williams, a statistics expert at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and Peter Wood, a Stanford University researcher who has been studying the effect of exercise on health since the 1970s. Williams and Wood collected detailed information on almost 13,000 habitual runners, all subscribers to Runner's World magazine, and then compared the weekly mileage of these runners with how much they weighed from year to year. Those who ran the most tended to weigh the least, but all these runners tended to get fatter with each passing year, even those who ran more than 40 miles a week. 8 miles a day, say, 5 days a week. This observation led Williams and Wood, both believers in the doctrine of calories in, calories out, to suggest that even the most dedicated runners had to increase their distance by a few miles a week, year after year, expend even more energy as they got older, if they wanted to remain lean. If men added 2 miles to their weekly distance every year, and women 3, according to Williams and Wood, then they might manage to remain lean, because this might mean expending in running the calories that they seemed fated otherwise to accumulate as fat. Let's see where that logic takes us. Imagine a man in his 20s who runs 20 miles a week, say 4 miles a day, 5 days a week. According to Williams and Wood, and the logic and mathematics of calories in, calories out, he will have to double that in his 30s, 8 miles a day, 5 days a week, and triple it in his 40s, 12 miles a day, 5 days a week, to keep fat from accumulating. A woman in her 20s who runs 3 miles a day, 5 times a week, an impressive but not excessive amount, would have to up her daily distance to 15 miles in her 40s to retain her youthful figure. If she does 8-minute miles, a nice pace for such a distance, she'd better be prepared to spend 2 hours on each of her running days to keep her weight in check. If we believe in calories in, calories out, and that in turn leads us to conclude that we have to run half marathons 5 days a week in our 40s and more in our 50s and more in our 60s to maintain our weight, it may, once again, be time to question our underlying beliefs. Maybe it's something other than the calories we consume and expend that determines whether we get fat. The ubiquitous faith in the belief that the more calories we expend, the less we'll weigh, is based ultimately on one observation and one assumption. The observation is that people who are lean tend to be more physically active than those of us who aren't. This is undisputed. Marathon runners, as a rule, are not overweight or obese. The front runners in marathons often look emaciated. But this observation tells us nothing about whether runners would be fatter if they didn't run, or if the pursuit of distance running as a full-time hobby will turn a fat man or woman into a lean marathoner. We base our belief in the fat-burning properties of exercise on the assumption that we can increase our energy expenditure, calories out, without being compelled to increase our energy intake, calories in. Burn 150 extra calories every day in exercise and keep it up for a month, as New York Times reporter Gina Colada calculated in her 2004 book, Ultimate Fitness, and you could lose a pound if you do not change your diet. The key question, though, is whether this is a reasonable possibility. Is it true that we can increase our expenditure of calories, burn an extra 150 calories a day, say, or go from being sedentary to active, or from active to very active, without changing our diet, without eating more, and without maybe decreasing the amount of energy we expend in the hours between our bouts of exercise? The simple answer, again, is no. I've already introduced the concept that explains why, one that used to seem perfectly obvious, but has now been relegated to the dustbin of exercise and nutrition history. This is the idea that if we increase our physical activity, we will work up an appetite. If you go for a walk or rake some leaves, take a long hike, play two sets of tennis or 18 holes of golf, you work up an appetite. You get hungry or hungrier. Increase the energy you expend, and the evidence is very good that you will increase the calories you consume to compensate. That we have gotten to the place in our lives and in the science of exercise, nutrition, and weight, where this concept of working up an appetite, of the body's increasing its intake of energy to compensate for its increased expenditure, has been forgotten, is one of the stranger stories in the history of modern medical research, or at least I hope it is. Until the 1960s, most clinicians who treated obese patients dismissed as naive the notion that we could lose weight through exercise or gain it by being sedentary. When Russell Wilder, an obesity and diabetes specialist at the Mayo Clinic, lectured on obesity in 1932, he said his fat patients lost more weight with bed rest, while unusually strenuous physical exercise slows the rate of loss. The patient reasons quite correctly, Wilder said, that the more exercise he takes, the more fat should be burned and that loss of weight should be in proportion, and he is discouraged to find that the scales reveal no progress. The patient's reasoning had two flaws, as Wilder's contemporaries would point out. First, we burn surprisingly few calories doing moderate exercise. And second, the effort can be easily undone, and probably will be, by mindless changes in diet. A 250-pound man will burn 3 extra calories climbing 1 flight of stairs, as Lewis Newberg of the University of Michigan calculated in 1942. He will have to climb 20 flights of stairs to rid himself of the energy contained in 1 slice of bread. So why not skip the stairs and skip the bread and call it a day? After all, what are the chances that if a 250-pounder does climb 20 extra flights a day, he won't eat the equivalent of an extra slice of bread before the day is done? Yes, more strenuous exercise will burn more calories. It really is much more effective to exercise hard enough to sweat, Colada tells us, and that is the only way to burn large numbers of calories. But, as these physicians argued, it will also make you hungrier still. Vigorous muscle exercise usually results in immediate demand for a large meal, noted Hugo Ronnie of Northwestern University in 1940. Consistently high or low energy expenditures result in consistently high or low levels of appetite. Thus, men doing heavy physical work spontaneously eat more than men engaged in sedentary occupations. Statistics show that the average daily caloric intake of lumberjacks is more than 5,000 calories, while that of tailors is only about 2,500 calories. Persons who change their occupation from light to heavy work, or vice versa, soon develop corresponding changes in their appetite. So, if a tailor becomes a lumberjack and, by doing so, takes to eating like one, why assume the same thing wouldn't happen, albeit to a lesser extent, to an overweight tailor who chooses to work out like a lumberjack for an hour a day? When researchers now discuss the relationship between physical activity and calorie intake in populations, as opposed to individuals, this is still perceived as a given. As Walter Willett and Meyer Stompfer of Harvard noted in the 1998 textbook, Nutritional Epidemiology, in most instances, energy intake can be interpreted as a crude measure of physical activity. The dubious credit for why we came to believe otherwise goes almost exclusively to one man, Jean Mayer, who began his professional career at Harvard in 1950, proceeded to become the most influential nutritionist in the United States, and then, for 16 years, served as president of Tufts University, where there is now a Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on aging. Those who have ever believed that they can lose fat and keep it off by exercising have Jean Mayer to thank. As an authority on human weight regulation, Mayer was among the very first of a new breed, a type that has since come to dominate the field. His predecessors, Brook, Wilder, Ronnie, Newberg, and others, had all been physicians who worked closely with obese and overweight patients. Mayer was not. His training was in physiological chemistry. He wrote his doctoral thesis at Yale University on the relationship of vitamins A and C in rats. He would eventually publish hundreds of papers on nutrition, including Why We Get Fat. But his job never actually required that he reduce a fat person to a healthy weight, and so his ideas were less fettered by real-life experience. It was Mayer who pioneered the now ubiquitous practice of implicating sedentary living as the most important factor leading to obesity and the chronic diseases that accompany it. Modern Americans, said Mayer, were inert compared with their pioneer forebears, who were constantly engaged in hard physical labor. Every modern convenience, by this logic, from riding lawnmowers to the electric toothbrush, only serves to reduce the calories we expend. The development of obesity, Mayer wrote in 1968, is to a large extent the result of the lack of foresight of a civilization which spends tens of billions annually on cars, but is unwilling to include a swimming pool and tennis courts in the plans of every high school. Mayer actually began extolling exercise as a means of weight control in the early 1950s, a few years out of graduate school, after studying a strain of obese mice that had a surprisingly small appetite. This seemed to absolve eating too much from being the cause of their obesity, so Mayer naturally assumed their sedentary behavior must be responsible, and they were certainly sedentary. They barely moved. By 1959, the New York Times was giving Mayer credit for having debunked the popular theories that exercise was of little value in weight control, which he hadn't. Mayer acknowledged that appetite tended to increase with physical activity, but the heart of his argument was that it wasn't necessarily the case. He believed there was a loophole in the relationship between expending more energy and eating more as a result. If exercise is decreased below a certain point, Mayer explained in 1961, food intake no longer decreases. In other words, walking 1/2 hour a day may be equivalent to only 4 slices of bread. Mayer was exaggerating to make his point. He often did. But if you don't walk the 1/2 hour, you still want to eat the 4 slices. So, if you're sufficiently sedentary, you're going to eat just as much as you would if you were a little active and expended more energy. Mayer based this conclusion on 2, and only 2, of his own studies from the mid-1950s. The first was on laboratory rats, purporting to demonstrate that when these rats were forced to exercise for a few hours every day, they ate less than rats that didn't exercise at all. Mayer didn't say that they actually weighed less, only that they ate less. As it turns out, rats on these exercise programs eat more on days when they aren't forced to run and will expend less energy when they're not exercising. Their weights, however, remain the same as those of sedentary rats. And when rats are retired from these exercise programs, they eat more than ever and gain weight with age more rapidly than rats that are allowed to remain sedentary. With hamsters and gerbils, exercise increases body weight and body fat percentage. So exercising makes these particular rodents fatter, not leaner. Mayer's second study was an assessment of the diet, physical activity, and weight of workers and merchants at a mill in West Bengal, India. This article is still cited, by the Institute of Medicine, for instance, as perhaps the only existing evidence that physical activity and appetite do not necessarily go hand in hand. But it, too, would never be replicated, despite, or perhaps because of, a half century of improvements in methods of assessing diet and energy expenditure in humans. The Bengali research is a case study in how bad supposedly seminal research can be in the field of nutrition. The jobs of the men working in this Indian mill, as Mayer reported, ranged from extraordinarily inert stallholders who sat at their shop all day long to furnace tenders who shoveled ashes and coal for a living. The evidence reported in Mayer's paper could have been used to demonstrate any point. The more active workers in the mill, for example, both weighed more and ate more than less active workers. As for the sedentary workers, the more sedentary they were, the more they ate, the less they weighed. The clerks who lived on the premises and sat all day long weighed 10 to 15 pounds less and were reported to have eaten 400 calories more on average than clerks who had to walk 3 to 6 miles to work, or even than those clerks who walked to work and also played soccer every day. It helped that Mayer promoted his pro-exercise message with a fervor akin to a moral crusade. And as Mayer's political influence grew through the 1960s, this contributed to the appearance that his faith in the weight-reducing benefits of exercise was widely shared. In 1966, when the U.S. Public Health Service first advocated dieting and increased physical activity as the keys to weight loss, Mayer wrote the report. 3 years later, he chaired a White House conference on food, nutrition, and health. The successful treatment of obesity must involve far-reaching changes in lifestyle, the conference report concluded. These changes include alterations of dietary patterns and physical activity. In 1972, when Mayer began writing a syndicated newspaper column on nutrition, he came across like a diet doctor selling a patent claim. Exercise, he wrote, would make weight melt away faster, and, contrary to popular belief, exercise won't stimulate your appetite. Meanwhile, the evidence never supported Mayer's hypothesis. Not in animals, as I said, and certainly not in humans. One remarkable study of the effect of physical activity on weight loss was published in 1989 by a team of Danish researchers. The Danes actually did train sedentary subjects to run marathons, 26.2 miles. After 18 months of training, and after actually running a marathon, the 18 men in the study had lost an average of 5 pounds of body fat. As for the 9 women subjects, the Danes reported no change in body composition was observed. That same year, Xavier Pissounier, director of the St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Obesity Research Center in New York, reviewed the existing trials testing the notion that increasing exercise would lead to weight loss. His conclusion was identical to that of the Finnish review in 2000. Decreases, increases, and no changes in body weight and body composition have been observed. We bought into the idea that we could exercise more and not compensate by eating more because the health reporters bought it, and their articles in the lay press were widely read. The research literature itself was not. In 1977, for instance, in the midst of the exercise explosion, the National Institutes of Health hosted its second-ever conference on obesity and weight control, and the assembled experts concluded that the importance of exercise in weight control is less than might be believed, because increases in energy expenditure due to exercise also tend to increase food consumption, and it is not possible to predict whether the increased caloric output will be outweighed by the greater food intake. That same year, the New York Times Magazine reported that there was now strong evidence that regular exercise can and does result in substantial and, so long as the exercise is continued, permanent weight loss. That evidence was the carefully controlled experiments of John Mayer, showing that moderate amounts